Our reading is adapted from The Low Road by Marge Piercy. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up. They can bust you. They can break your fingers. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight, you can refuse, you can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration, 100 fill a hall, 1,000 have solidarity and your own newsletter. 10,000 power in your own paper, 100,000 your own media, 10 million your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day, you mean one more. That powerful poem ends with such a beautiful line. It starts when you say we and you know who you mean. And each day, you mean one more. What do we mean when we say we? This past week, our nation celebrated its independence from England almost 250 years ago with barbecues and flags, parades and fireworks. As a nation, we have many myths. Stories are important for creating a culture. The story that I want to explore today is the one about the melting pot, the great power of the United States to serve as a place where many different cultures come together and become something new. Out of many, one, e pluribus unum. What do we mean when we say we? And do we always mean one more? The melting pot is not part of the inscription on the Statue of Liberty, but that statue and this poem by Emma Lazarus celebrates the myth of welcome, inclusion, and togetherness that the melting pot was intended to uphold. That poem, entitled The New Colossus, of which we heard a part during our special music this morning, goes like this. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. It is part of our national mythology that we are a people of welcome. This is true also of Unitarian Universalist congregations, but I will leave that aside for a moment. Any quick glance at our United States history can tell us that this mythology, this story of worldwide welcome, was never true, even as it was being created. Signs clearly stating that the Irish need not apply or Italians are not welcome were common until only the last few generations. But our story was that if people made it here from their homeland, they were allowed to stay and try their best. Immigrants were not necessarily welcomed with open arms, but if they made it to Ellis Island or some other port, they could stay. There was no such thing as illegal immigration to the United States until 1882, when the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed by Congress to prohibit the immigration of Chinese laborers. It was expanded in 1924 when all Asian immigration was halted. 1924, that's less than 100 years ago. Both of these laws emerged when the economy in the United States was in a lull, when white people felt like their job prospects were being threatened by foreigners. So now we find ourselves at yet another crossroads in American history, when the story of who we are as a people is being written. Who are we? Who do we want to be? As the reporting from the border comes out with images of young children separated from their parents, being held in warehouses without blankets or affection, many of us find ourselves numb with horror and rage. It's easy to say this is not who we are, but our history shows us that it is. It is who we are. White people in the United States have a long history of separating the families of people deemed not like us, particularly the children born to slaves, sold again into slavery far away from the people who love them, or the children of Native Americans removed from their families and sent to boarding schools where they were stripped of their culturally significant clothes, hair, language, rituals, and communities. So this is who we are. It is who we have been, but the power of mythology is that it tells the story of who we want to be. Which brings me to the metaphor of the melting pot. In 1908, the term melting pot was popularized. It had been used before, but it was popularized when Israel Zwangli published a play entitled The Melting Pot, and it was performed at a theater in Washington, D.C. The play starred an immigrant protagonist, and that protagonist says in one scene, quote, "Understand that America is God's crucible, the great melting pot where all the races of Europe are melting and reforming. Here you stand, good folk, think I, when I see them at Ellis Island. Here you stand in your 50 groups, your 50 languages, your histories, your 50 blood, hatreds, and rivalries. But you won't be long like that, brothers, for these are the fires of God you've come to. A fig for your feuds and vendettas, Germans and Englishmen, Frenchmen and Irishmen, Jews and Russians, into the crucible with you all. God is making the American." Who does Zwangli say the melting pot includes? Yeah, the European. He says the European. Though in this case, Zwangli, himself a Jew, does include Jews among those worthy of intermixing in the crucible. But essentially, the melting pot is white folks. The Native American is not included. The black person is not included. But there is something beautiful about the idea that the melting pot burns away animosity. Gone be your feuds and vendettas. They have no use here. This reminds me a lot of why people come to Unitarian Universalist congregations. We like to lift up unity in Unitarian as a goal for who we might be, out of many, one. We have bumper stickers that say things like many religions, one faith, or coexist with many religious symbols. There is beauty in finding our commonalities. Indeed, the melting pot metaphor was well intended, but it had a fatal flaw. And in order to understand that flaw, I need to talk a little bit about theory. This theory is called the Intercultural Development Continuum, or the IDC. The Intercultural Development Continuum says that we are all born with a preference for the culture we know, with strong in-group prejudice. I always cringe when I hear people say things like, children don't see color. They absolutely do. Children are hardwired to see group similarities and differences. It's part of what kept them safe and endeared them to their caregivers in a highly social society throughout our early evolution. Creating categories, us and them, is part of our nature. Ask any child and they will tell you what category things fall into, whether we like it or not. But this theory says that over time, if we work at it, we can progress along a continuum of growing to understand and appreciate and work well with cultural differences. According to the theory, this is developmental. It proceeds from one stage to the next. You can't skip ahead without going through the particular stages. Some of us, if exposed to a lot of positive encounters with cultural difference, can skip ahead to a further stage pretty early in life. Some might get stuck somewhere. Some might never move very far. But the thing I like about the intercultural development continuum is that it's not shaming. It doesn't say being at this stage is bad. It just says this is where you are, and here are ways to move along the continuum if you want to have more depth of understanding of cultures other than your own. The first stage in the continuum is called denial. It says there are no cultural differences. If there are differences between us, it's just because we've chosen different actions. The subtext in that is usually that the other person's actions are not only different, but wrong. People in the denial stage actively avoid contact with other cultures. The next stage is called polarization. It acknowledges cultural differences, unlike denial, which doesn't. But polarization creates stark lines between us and them. Now, there are two ways to be in polarization. One is to believe that one's own culture is superior to others. This one is obvious. Yeah, I have a culture, they have a culture, mine's just better and does things the right way. But the other way is to believe that one's own culture is inferior to others. This could take the form of internalized racism, people of color actively disliking anything associated with their own culture and trying to do things that might seem white. It sounds to me like this is what our worship leader Dee talked about with her mom. But it can also take the form of white folks who fetishize or glorify the culture of other communities and constantly put down whites. Both of these ways of being in polarization lack nuance. They don't have any nuance in understanding one's own culture or another culture. It's very either or. The third stage is called minimization. Now, there's a test you can take. It's called the Intercultural Development Inventory, and my hope is to bring that here to the fellowship in the coming year or so. So if you want to learn more about where you are on this continuum, you can take the test and do some work with us. But most people who take this test end up in stage three, minimization, particularly liberal white folks, including the majority of Unitarian Universalists. In fact, I took this test along with about 50 members of my previous UU congregation, and most of us tested at this stage. Minimization is the stage where we try to minimize or erase our differences in order to find the commonalities. People in minimization say things like, "We're all the same deep down." Or, "I don't see you as black, you're just like me." Or, "You don't have an accent, you sound cute." The intent of these statements is to find commonality, which, as we've already discussed, is good. It's a good thing. But the effect of statements like this can be to erase a part of someone's identity. And generally, people don't like having parts of themselves erased. There are two other stages: acceptance, whose hallmark is to be curious about and open to differences in culture, and finally, adaptation, which allows for bridge building and moving comfortably between cultures without fetishizing or demonizing one's own culture or another's. But I want to focus on minimization since that is so common. I call stage three the melting pot stage. Back to our melting pot metaphor, here is a story about the Henry Ford English School, which was an actual part of the Ford Motor Company's attempt to educate its workforce to be productive members of society. Remember, most of Ford's employees were immigrants. And so the Ford English School was a way to teach not only our language, but all the cultural ways of being American, such as what color suit to wear and what type of toothpaste was best. This story comes from the novel Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides. But research into the English school shows that this fictionalized story is historically accurate. For context, Lefty is the grandfather. But at the time of this part in the book, he was still young. He had recently immigrated to the United States with his new wife, Desdemona, from Greece. A pageant was planned to celebrate the Ford English School graduation. As a top student, Lefty was asked to take part. "What kind of pageant?" his wife Desdemona asked. "I can't tell you. It's a surprise. But you have to sew me some clothes." "What kind?" "Like from the Pedrita." Weeks later, we are in the Detroit Light Guard Armory, 7 p.m. An assembled audience of 2,000 settles down as the house lights dim. Prominent business leaders greet each other with handshakes. The curtain parts to gasps and scattered applause. A painted flat shows a steamship, two huge smokestacks, and a swatch of deck and railing. A gangway extends into the stage's other focal point, a giant gray cauldron, emblazoned with the words Ford English School Melting Pot. A European folk melody begins to play. Suddenly, a lone figure appears on the gangway, dressed in a Balkan costume of vest, ballooning trousers, and high leather boots. The immigrant carries his possessions on a stick. He looks around with apprehension and then descends into the melting pot. Now, Syria descends into the pot. Then Italy, Poland, Norway, Palestine, and finally, Greece. "Look, it's Lefty." Wearing embroidered palikari vest, puffy-sleeved puka miso, and pleated fustanella skirt, my grandfather bestrides the gangway. He pauses a moment to look out at the audience, but the bright lights blind him. He can't see my grandmother looking at him. Germany taps him on the back. "Macht schnell, excuse me, go fastly." In the front row, Henry Ford nods with approval, enjoying the show. The English instructors appear on stage next. They carry long spoons, which they insert into the pot. The lights turn red and flicker as the instructors stir. Steam rises over the stage. Inside the cauldron, men are packed together, throwing off immigrant costumes, putting on suits. Limbs are tangled up, feet stepping on feet. "Pardon me, excuse me." Feeling thoroughly American, Lefty pulls on his blue wool trousers and jacket. In his mouth, 32 teeth brushed in the American manner. His underarms are sprinkled with American deodorant. And now spoons are descended from above. Men are churning around and around, and the melting pot boils over. Red lights brighten. The orchestra launches into Yankee Doodle. One by one, the Ford English School graduates rise out from the cauldron. Dressed in blue and gray suits, they climb to the top, waving American flags to thunderous applause. The school really existed. And this was actually how their graduation ceremony happened. This is an actual photograph from one of the Ford English School graduations. Now, I can only imagine what it felt like to be Desdemona. She was asked to create a costume from back home, something that would have been worn for a formal ceremony, like a graduation from her husband's new workplace. I can imagine her pride seeing her new young husband crossing the plank in his traditional clothes, carrying the name of his their country, then only to see him emerge having shed those things. The vest, the puka miso skirt, shirt, the pleated skirt, all in a heap with other traditional costumes at the bottom of the cauldron, discarded, waste, in favor of the American suits and American flags. This is minimization. It says, in order to be American, you have to be these things. You have to wear certain clothes. You have to worship a certain way. You can only speak one language. You have to brush your teeth in this particular way. You cannot be both Greek and American. You can only be one. And American means this very limited thing. Henry Ford is often celebrated as a champion of the working man. He raised the minimum wage from $2.50 to $5 per day, after all. But the truth is that he kept that additional wage in escrow for a year, only to give it to the employee after a year of perfect attendance and home visits by the Ford Sociological Department, which would ensure that the workers were living upright American lives, including proper hygiene and not mixing with the wrong sort of people. Now, I can only imagine being a man, probably a man, desperate for a better life for myself and my family, coming across the sea to this place, securing employment with Ford Motors, only to be told that I must conform in these various ways in order to be paid the wage that I need in order to succeed. I would probably do whatever was asked of me. I would probably fall in line, get along, and support my family. It's often said that whiteness has a culture of its own, that one of the hallmarks of whiteness is that it requires the loss of any other particular cultural markers. This is why so many white people, particularly in the United States, have very little awareness of their own heritage or cultural history. We might know that we are a quarter Irish and half Norwegian, but we don't have any idea what that means. In order to become American, in order to become white, our ancestors, either recent or long ago, shed their language, their holidays, the O in front of their last name, their songs and stories, in order to fit in with the rest of the melting pot. And this has also served to continually exclude others who can't as easily fit in, those who don't speak English, whether that was the Irish immigrants 100 years ago or the Central and South American immigrants today, or those who don't have white skin, blacks, Asians, and Latinx folks throughout our history. The myth of the melting pot promises welcome. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The myth of the melting pot promised connection, the creation of a new population free of prejudice. But the myth of the melting pot also served to remove the very things from each of us that are unique and different and strengthen our society. Monoculture is not only boring, it's dangerous. Any farmer can tell you that diversity provides strength and resistance against weather, disease, and pests. Diverse cultures are likewise powerful and beautiful in their different colors, languages, customs, and strengths. I'm not going to pretend that differences don't cause problems. Particularly, differences in values and beliefs can cause clashes when they bump up against each other. But different opinions, values, and beliefs can provide an important check and balance on extremism, especially when given forums for expression and dialogue. Where we can learn from each other to grow and understand each other, even if we never come to fully agree. Differences and diversity is good. Modern historians, politicians, and writers have called for a different metaphor, not the melting pot of old, but instead a salad bowl or a mosaic that recognizes all the different elements, still separate, but contributing to a beautiful whole. In a salad, each element is distinct, but combined, they make a delicious whole, better together than if they were separate. Similarly, in a mosaic, the separate glass pieces are not melded together into a single piece. Instead, they each shine uniquely, but all together as an image that could not be created by any one of them alone. In recent decades, and certainly in the last couple of years, we Unitarian Universalists have also been challenged to recognize all the ways that we as a faith tradition have been in minimization, especially with our desire to come together to be with, quote, like-minded people. We've recently been confronted by UUs of color about the ways in which this tradition harms Unitarian Universalists of color and perpetuates whiteness, just as the melting pot has done for immigrants throughout the history of our nation. And so Unitarian Universalists have begun to focus on diversity as an important and powerful goal. Our celebration of diversity in recent years has lifted up the power of honoring and learning, celebrating different cultures, striving to avoid misappropriation. We try to welcome everyone. I'm proud to be part of a faith that recognizes the power, strength, and beauty in diversity. But diversity for the sake of diversity is missing the point. We do not, or we should not, welcome people into our communities, into our congregations, or our nation only because they are different from us. That's not diversity, that's tokenism. Seeing only our differences cannot lead to understanding, knowledge, and strength. Diversity for the sake of diversity is a mosaic without the grout. Each piece is lovely, but it doesn't provide the connections to create the unique big picture. It's just a pile of glass. The grout, my friends, is our commonalities. The grout is the stuff about us that's the same. And I'll talk more about that next week. We need both. We need our differences and our commonalities, and we need not mush them together into a single melting pot. It starts when you say, we, and you know who we mean, and each day we mean one more. Amen. May it be so.